from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, a look forward and a look back. First, the Falcons will soon begin their last season in the Georgia Dome. Could it be a winning season this time? Plus, a new photo exhibit chronicles the height of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. That's when a diagnosis was like a death sentence.
We've had patients who were diagnosed on the first same visit that they died of their complications, which is obviously not the way we should be doing it.
We'll go south to Savannah for an opera with a spooky theme as well. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, in the break room last week, we talked about a movement to cut down on food waste by selling produce that's less than beautiful.
Come along, Dorothy. You don't want any of those apples.
Are you hinting my apples on what they ought to be?
Oh, no. It's just that she doesn't like little green worms.
We wanted to know if you were willing to buy ugly food, and here are your first thoughts. Jason Ganesh tweets, I go straight to the discount produce rack first thing when I buy groceries. 3 red bell peppers for $1. Who cares if it has a bruise? Also on Twitter, Boyd Martin writes, you would buy that produce if you knew what they put in it to make them perfect. And Bruce Scherer tweets, discount meat section, my first stop at Safeway, 50% off often, hashtag fixed income. We always love to get your shopping tips or anything else you have to say. You can call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. You know, fall is nearly upon us, and that means pumpkin spice flavored everything, and it also means football. The NFL preseason kicked off last week for all 32 professional teams. The Falcons will look to bounce back after a pretty disappointing 2015 season. They also hope to make their last season in the Georgia Dome a memorable one. The Falcons move to Mercedes-Benz Stadium next year. So here to preview our upcoming season of football is GPB's own John Nelson, a correspondent for GPB Sports. Good to have you again.
Good to be here.
So I was at the dog park, and there was a group of like 5 or 6 football fans, and here was the general tenor of their conversation.
Right.
This year will be different.
How?
Well, they said there's a whole bunch of new players coming in.
Yeah, if they make the 53-man roster, yes.
And that's going to bring new blood and new energy.
But it could also present itself a lack of continuity and take everybody a while to get to full song. So it's all about the adjustment phase.
All right, so let's weigh the pluses and minuses.
Sure.
Here.
Are we going to take our piece of paper and put it in half and do like the pluses
on one
side?
We could.
That
wouldn't help too much on radio.
Oh, I know.
But, okay, so new blood, how does that weigh against continuity and experience?
Well, okay, new blood, obviously it would depend on the experience of the new blood and the position. They're kicking the tires on a guy like Dwight Freeney, an experienced pass rusher. Last year, the Falcons, when it came to rushing the passer, were dead last in the National Football League when it came to pass rush efficiency and putting the other quarterback on his back so you could have a decent shot at short fields and scoring. You're going to have new guys at linebacker and defensive back. They drafted that way, trying to have the Dan Quinn Seattle defense version 2.0 with the low draft picks, meaning guys seventh round and such free agents
right.
who can make those kinds of impacts. But do you want to rely on rookies hoping that they're going to be that first year guy that's really going to make that impact and smash the defense the way it's supposed to be? Or is there going to be a learning curve and they're not going to get there until week 4, week 5? That's the rub in all of this.
Okay, but there is a claim that Julio Jones
right.
is the best wide receiver.
So who's your number two?
Oh.
Once you got rid of Roddy White, who's your number two? You're going to have someone step up. Obviously, with a guy like Jacob Tammy at tight end, the position is secure there. But who's going to step up and be your number two receiver? That's another issue. Who's going to block and make sure that Matt Ryan doesn't end up on his back a lot like he did last year?
The quarterback.
So you have all of this dynamic in play. And looking at the schedule, I was extrapolating. And that's a fancy word for a sports guy, extrapolating. I had him at 6-6 going into the last 4 weeks of the season, and the division.
Wait, but that's not a winning season.
I've got him 9-7 ish, and I mean, but that's you know, playoffs and winning season, they're two different things, especially in the street fight that is going to be the NFC this year.
Okay, so before we talk about their new digs,
yeah,
let's talk about A, chances for a winning season, winning at least one more game than they lose.
I would say that if they win
don't
three of
their... Don't say 50-50.
No, I'd say if they win three of their last four, then that would be a plus, because if I've got them at 6-6, they're going to have to... It's probably going to come down to that last game of the season against New Orleans one way or the other.
And, okay, so chances they could get into the playoffs.
That's a different thing entirely, because you're going to have a lot of teams at 9-7, some at 10-6. You're having me do math this early in the morning. 10-6 is probably what's going to get you into the playoffs. Maybe a 9-7 is a 6 seed. So, yeah, they're going to be right there. And
you're not ready to put your money on it.
No, 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 no. It's the beginning of the season. Everything's in pencil with me. I reserve the right to use the other end of the pencil in a race and go from there at the end of October.
Okay. Fair enough.
Uh-huh.
Fair enough. We are talking to GPP sports correspondent John Nelson. We're talking about the upcoming NFL season for the Atlanta Falcons. Let's divert just for a moment.
Divert, another fancy word.
To talk about the Georgia Dome.
Sure.
It's possible that this could be a difficult season for the Falcons in the Georgia Dome. There are inklings that they could not fill all the seats there.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to depend on that early part of the season, because the road trips that they have, they're dealing with the AFC West this year. They go to Oakland. They go to Denver. They're going to be playing in Seattle as well. So it depends on that early part of the road schedule. And if you're 3-5 at the halfway point, then you're going to have folks who are going to sit there and go, I don't know if I want to show up. I mean, last year, went to the Saints game with the boss, a.k.a. the better half. And we were in the fourth quarter at 2 hours and 8 minutes. I mean, this game was flying by, because neither team was going to be in the playoffs, and they wanted to get out of Dodge. And if you have another season like you had last year, you're going to have game 15 and game 16 with that same kind of impact and a lot of chairs that are going to be empty, resembling Falcons fans.
Okay, so here's a clip of Arthur Blank talking about, this was recorded during training camp,
right.
He's talking about the end of an era at the Dome.
I'm excited about it. It represents a lot of history for Atlanta. A lot of great events were held there, and we've obviously played there for many years, and it'll be fun when it's imploded. My kids all want to have a hand on the compression thing when they blow it up. And so it's, you know, I think it's been a great facility for us.
Okay, so you can understand what I want to ask about.
That would be so cool to be the person who pushes the button to implode the building.
Right, but what do you think is the effect on all of the people in Atlanta who are upset about the destruction of the Georgia Dome to hear Arthur Blank saying it'll be fun when it's imploded?
Yeah, I think that really a lot of folks are looking at the Falcons going, why did you build this new thing when the building that you currently have seems to be fairly functional already? And I think that this happens in a lot of cities, and it's happening with the folks up in Cobb County right now, too, with the Braves. And all of these different professional franchises and their owners and their teams. And I want to say it was in Bloomberg, was it, a couple of months ago, that had a really great article on the trickle-down effect that the Braves have with all of their minor league teams and their stadia. And I think that you're having a backlash right now with a lot of fans across the country about all these owners who want to build these new shiny...
Using taxpayer dollars.
That. You want to build these new shiny castles with taxpayer dollars, and people are just over it right now. And I don't know.
Possibly because they also want to keep the profits for themselves.
Yeah, and that's what you want. You're building your barn for your place so you can get your piece of the pie, which is bigger than it was in the old place. And I think a lot of fans across the country are being turned off by that kind of stuff right now.
So what do you think about the crowds?
Crowds, I mean... As you well know, when it comes to football, being a Lions person, winning cures all. And if you win,
the seats are full every time, and they haven't won in ages.
Because it's football. You only have, including the exhibition season, you have only 10 opportunities to see your favorite team unless you go on the road.
It's true.
Football seems to be bulletproof in a lot of different areas. College is bulletproof. I think that the pro football game is bulletproof to a great degree. You had 90,000 people in Los Angeles for the first Rams exhibition game. So right now, I think that once you you have this big shiny thing called football. People kind of just forget about everything that they're mad about. And then when the season's over and their team doesn't make the playoffs, then they get mad all over again.
Okay, that was John Nelson predicting the Falcons won't make the playoffs. Okay, let's
save this tape.
On that note, I'm going to play this this comment from the Falcons head coach Dan Quinn. This is at the end of last season, right? And he's talking at a press conference.
Spoke to the team as they were leaving the locker room today, and one of the messages I want to get across to him, so I'm going to read it just so we can all kind of understand where I was coming from. One cannot understand what it means to be relentless until you've struggled to possess something that is just out of your reach. And for us, that's the postseason, and that hurts. And we didn't get that part done.
Okay, so his pep talk to the team was, we're reaching something that we can't reach. This comes off recent research that shows that locker room speeches aren't very effective.
I think it's a generational thing. I think that, you know, people who are half my age, considering I'm 162.
You look good.
Thank you. I think that if you're up front with folks, I think these days, I think that means more than if you're trying to sit there and plant a flag and sit there and be all flowery and, you know, right in people's
faces. That sounds like you're saying good on Dan Quinn for being honest.
Well, I mean, I would rather be honest about something, but honest in a sense, in listening to that Dan Quinn quote, it was almost like he was trying to twist a negative. It's like, look, I would rather have a coach say, we're almost there. We need to focus on what we need to work on to get past that point. I wouldn't say that the playoffs are unreachable in any aspect. I would say, do as best you can. I'm proud of you either way. Let's see what we can do, and let's build on what we've built. And Dan Quinn has built a lot in a very short time, but there's still a lot that has to be built. I would rather be upfront and honest about that.
Okay, so in the short time that we have left, what are those things? You're saying that he needs to focus on the things that which they're lacking. So
yeah, pass rush. You gotta get to the other guy. You've got to get to the quarterback. A number one exclamation point, pass rush, have a number two receiver, and keep Matt Ryan, the quarterback, upright yourself.
Well, can they just do a running game and bypass their quarterback altogether?
Tevin Coleman showed a lot last year. I don't think that you can really be a ground and pound and make it in this year's NFL. I think you have to be diverse.
Okay.
Be diverse.
So this is what you're looking for. And if you see those things,
then you're still going to be 9-7 because you're still growing.
So the best they're going to do, you in your mind,
10-6 would be a best. I think that it could be anywhere from 7-9 to 10-6, depending on how they do on the road. But 9-7 is where I'm looking at it right now.
But there you go. That's still a winning season.
Yes, but you go winning season, and then you want to advance the topic to playoffs. There's going to be a lot of folks at 9-7. It could come down to tiebreakers and how many points you've scored against common opponents. You could be like the ninth tiebreaker and still not be
there.
I'm
going to see this as hopeful, though, because 9-7 is still a significant improvement over last season.
Yes, but once again, remember that this has been a franchise where it's been winning season, losing season, winning season, losing season for the first 30 years of their existence.
Thanks for dimming my light there, John Nelson.
You're a Lions fan.
It's true.
Dimming your light about the Falcons and you're a Lions fan.
Yeah.
Honolulu blue and silver, baby. Woo!
I've been speaking with John Nelson. He's a correspondent for GPB Sports. You can catch John and the rest of the
GPB
Sports team.
But you don't have Calvin Johnson anymore.
On Football Fridays in Georgia.
This Friday.
That starts this week on GPB TV.
7:30.
Always a pleasure, John.
Anytime.
A new exhibit at Emory University sheds light on the HIV/AIDS crisis of the 1980s. It includes photos of HIV-positive people that were taken by Atlanta photographer Billy Howard. Billy joins me in our studio to talk more about this collection. Also with us is Doug Lothis. He agreed to be photographed for this project almost 30 years ago. He moved from Atlanta a few years ago to Palm Springs, California, and he joins us on the phone. Hi, Doug.
Celeste. Hi, Billy.
So let's start, Doug, by I'm wondering about that experience of being photographed, and you knew that this was for a collection of photos of other people also struggling through HIV or AIDS. So was it difficult for you to make the decision to be part of that?
Well, yes. It did take a little time. Billy came. I was in a support group at, I think it was the Atlanta Gay Center maybe at the time, and Billy came to us and made his proposal. And I probably took about a week before I got back in touch with him, because certainly in 1987, 88, the stigma around someone with HIV or AIDS was huge. And you couldn't get insurance, you could be denied a job, housing, the discrimination could be severe. So when I said, Billy, I really want to do this, but I don't want to be totally recognizable.
And that's why you have a turtleneck covering part of your face?
Correct. And my hands.
Billy, how difficult was it for you to convince people to be part of this collection of photos, especially at a time when a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS was, for many people, a death sentence?
Well, I knew that at the time, and the stigma was so intense that, for me, I decided that I didn't want to convince anybody to be a part of it. I wanted to create a project where they would come to me, so I needed to reach out and find ways to tell people about the project. And like Doug said, I went to a lot of support groups, and I would make a presentation, and I would leave my contact information and would say, there's no pressure. Anybody that, if somebody wants to be a part of this, they can contact me. So I waited for people to find me to photograph them for the project. I wanted them to be able to make the decision on their own without any pressure. And so when Doug called me, it was, he said he wanted to be a part of the project, but could, if I'm remembering correctly, you asked if you could be part of it without a photograph. And I said, you know, we couldn't do that,
but
we can work together to come up with a way to have you in the book without being recognized.
So, Doug, how has it been since then? And many, many years have passed, but I wonder what that was like when people first saw your photo in that collection and what kind of conversations you had.
Really, people didn't see it unless they purchased the book. And if they purchased the book, I wouldn't necessarily know it. So it just was out there. And without any recognizable name or my face, I really didn't have. Now, I would share it with friends and family, but actually nobody knew.
So do you wish that they had, or are you happy that it's more anonymous?
Oh, no. I wish, and I'm glad at the time that it did what it was supposed to do, because I was also pursuing a theater career in Atlanta, so I didn't want to be the face of AIDS in Atlanta or HIV, and that prohibited me from working.
And in many cases, Billy, from some of your stories, it sounds as though the biggest impact was on the people photographed themselves. I wonder if you'd tell me a little bit about Ron, who was the first person you photographed?
Ron was the first person I photographed. I met him at a Grady AIDS clinic. And Grady Hospital AIDS clinic. And it was like the whole project came together just in that one meeting. I was searching for something to do to address the AIDS epidemic, because my dentist, who had become a friend of mine, suddenly vanished. And I later found out that he had contracted AIDS, he had left Atlanta, died at his mother's home in Florida, and had completely isolated himself. And he was a vibrant, very fun man with a lot of friends, and he left them all.
Do you remember what year that was?
1987. It was the, 1986, because I started the project in 1987. And so I was looking for a way to respond to that. And when I met Ron, that was the entree into that world. And Ron and I bonded immediately. And later he told me the reason that he trusted me was that the first thing I did when I met him was reach out to shake his hand. And that was a period of time when a lot of healthcare workers and people in the police community would not touch somebody with AIDS unless they had latex gloves on. And that just had never, I never bought into that myth. So Ron was, it was similar to my dentist. He had been a healthcare administrator in Clayton County, And when he found out he was HIV positive, he left his job, left all his friends, told nobody where he was going. And when I met him, he was living in a one room, in a rooming house in Atlanta. And what he said in his statement when he wrote the words that he wrote under his picture was that he was afraid of dying all alone. One of the, in the first part of the project, the Atlanta paper, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, ran a story on what I was doing, and they ran Ron's picture. His friends and coworkers in Clayton County saw it in the paper and contacted me and said that they were worried about Ron, and they didn't know what had happened to him, and he had just kind of dropped off the face of the earth, and could they get in touch with him? So I reached out to Ron and asked him, and he said it was okay, and those coworkers became Ron's support group for the rest of his life.
So he did not.
So he did not die alone, which was his biggest fear. And
Because of the photo you took.
It's hard to judge whether you can make an impact with photography, but that one instance, to me, made the entire project worthwhile.
So, Doug, here we are. It's 2016, and Atlanta has a rate of HIV infection that rivals some countries in Africa. And I wonder if you have ideas why. Why, with all the education that we have now, with the improved medication that we have, why are we still struggling with such an incredibly high rate of infection here?
Well, I think part of it may be Atlanta is such a mecca in the southeastern United States for gays and lesbians and people of transgender orientation that they flock there. And they're coming in many cases from a very rural, not as forward-thinking areas of the South. And that may feed part of it, that they're less educated because AIDS now is looked at, and in many cases is, thanks be to God, a controllable infection. So there's also, I think, that plays a part of it, is that because of the medications, which have made great strides, incredible strides, I'm alive because of it, there's become a sort of laissez-faire attitude. If I get it, I can just start the pills. And now there's even PrEP, which is a prophylactic, where they give you the AIDS medication before you're even infected.
Right.
You're sexually active. So I think all of that's feeding into it.
My guest, you're hearing the voice of Doug Loth. He was one of the dozens of people photographed for this project by Atlanta photographer Billy Howard, who we've been speaking to. He built up a collection of photographs he took 30 years ago of people living with HIV. Each of these photographs comes with a message that the person themselves wrote. That collection is on display now at Emory. Since we're talking about infection rates, though, I want to turn the conversation to some recent research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Atlanta is the fifth highest metro area for new diagnoses, and I want to bring in now Nicole Roebuck. She's the executive director of AIDS Atlanta, which is Georgia's largest HIV/AIDS service organization. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, good morning.
Let's address this issue of new infections and your opinion on why Atlanta is so high, why we have not been able to bring down the rate of new infections to the level where we would like them to be, which I assume is near zero.
I think there are several factors that you may see in different publications. I think stigma is still an issue. You heard Billy talk about the huge stigma, and particularly in the African American community. Billy actually, I liked how he said it, it's like a double stigma on top of the racism, poverty issues that
And the Hispanic community as well.
And Hispanic community as well. I think even with the Hispanic community, they sometimes become invisible because of some of the laws in terms of immigration, so they've kind of disappeared. So do we really have a real handle on the Hispanic community and the disease in the community? I actually think it's much higher than is reported because of some of those issues with people in the Hispanic community fearing that if they go into a public place, a public clinic, they might be reported and somehow deported out of the country.
You think it may be higher. Now, at this point, the rate of infection is a 1 in 51 chance for all of Georgia. However, black men who have sex with other men had a 1 in 2 risk of being infected. Hispanic men had a 1 in 4 risk. That's compared with a Caucasian man of 1 in 11. You think that that rate of 1 in 4 for Hispanics may be higher than that?
I do. I do because you have to be present to be tested, you know, to be identified. You have to be present and come into a clinic to even be go into care.
To become part of statistics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if I'm afraid, though, that I might be reported to somebody, I might not come in because of some of the immigration laws.
But that causes a problem, and it can increase rates of infection.
Absolutely.
Because they're not being treated.
Exactly right.
They're not being tested.
That's exactly right. According to some recent statistics from Georgia's epidemiology division, there are about 20,000 people in Georgia who have been identified to be HIV. So they've been tested and they know they're HIV positive, but are not in care. They're not receiving care. Hmm. And so if they're not receiving care and they're not receiving those life-saving medications that help to lower a viral load and lower the incidence, the additional risk of transmission, then those people are also transmitting the disease.
Is Truvada a solution for people? Truvada is a pill, the only drug that has been proven to prevent HIV infection. I am told that some people see Truvada as the answer. If I'm taking Truvada, I don't have to take any other precautions. Is that correct?
I think it's one tool. We look at prevention in terms of a toolkit. So I think it's one of the tools in the toolkits that works for some people. The other issue, too, with Truvada, you asked about why in the South. There are a lot of poverty issues in the South. There is a lot of access issues in the South, access to health care, health insurance. And so people who may choose to use PrEP, you usually have to have some kind of insurance or the ability to pay for that PrEP and pay for those PrEP medications. For people who are the most at risk, honestly, in terms of disparate health outcomes, they are the people who don't have access to that PrEP because PrEP, you know, isn't free.
PrEP is short for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Exactly.
Which is supposed to prevent the infection.
Yes.
But this is all then... Let me go back right before in the last 2 minutes that we have. Let me go back to you, Billy, because 30 years on from this project that you started because you wanted to fight the stigma. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
You're hearing from someone who says people are still being affected because the stigma is still there. What, I mean, do you feel as though we've made progress at a good rate?
Well, obviously we've made progress, and Doug is an example of that. I mean, when Doug was when I photographed Doug in 1987, he needed to remain anonymous because health insurance companies and employers would fire people if they found out they were HIV positive. But today, Doug has come out. He's proudly living with a disease that he has been able to manage. He's one of the few people of over 70 that I photographed that survived. He's a survivor and a hero to me. But just his life is a testament that things have changed. But, yeah, I mean, we still have a long ways to go.
Doug, did you want to add to that in the last minute that we have?
I just wanted to say that I've been extremely blessed. The first 10 years of my infection, I didn't have any medication, so my body was able to fight it. And it was the addition of those medications that has kept me alive and the support of wonderful men like Billy. Folks in my life.
my guest, you're hearing the voice of Doug Loth. He was one of the dozens of people photographed for this project by Atlanta photographer Billy Howard, who we've been speaking to. He built up a collection of photographs he took 30 years ago of people living with HIV. Each of these photographs comes with a message that the person themselves wrote. That collection is on display now at Emory. Also, we spoke with AIDS Atlanta Executive Director Nicole Roebuck and former Atlanta resident Doug Loth, who's been living with HIV and AIDS for 30 years. Billy's work documenting people is at Emory University. You have to make an appointment to see them. More information on how to do that at gpbnews.org. We've also published a lovely gallery of the photos at our website, gpbnews.org. Tomorrow we'll talk about race relations in the United States. Police shootings get a lot of headlines, but Professor Mark Lamont Hill says we have to broaden the scope if we plan to solve inequalities. He'll join us tomorrow to talk about his new book, Nobody: Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. So what do you think is at the root of our racial tensions here in the States? Is there a root cause? Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning for more. Savannah is known as one of America's most haunted cities, so it fits that the Savannah Voice Festival would commission an opera about ghosts. Composer Michael Ching wrote Alice Riley about the first woman hanged in Georgia, and if you believe in ghosts, legend has it she continues to haunt Wright Square in Savannah, where she was killed. The Ghost Opera will return to the Savannah Voice Festival stage tomorrow at the Westin Savannah Harbor Ballroom. I spoke with composer Michael Ching last year when the opera first opened. Baritone James Wright also joined that conversation. He plays the character of Richard White, Alice Riley's lover. I started the conversation by asking Michael how much he feels the need to stick with historical facts when he's telling the story.
Actually, because it is so long ago and because there's only a certain amount known about this case, there is a lot of leeway.
Yeah.
For example, Alice got thrown out of her first posting when she was indentured. The first place that they sent her, she got removed from, but we don't know why. And so I make up the idea that she was praying in Gaelic and her master did not approve.
Because she came from Ireland and she's kind of a fiery redhead. But you made the choice to have two separate Alice Rileys in the opera. What was the thought behind that?
Well, the producer, Maria Zuvas, really wanted me to try to tell the story from multiple perspectives. And so the idea was to have an Alice that was just getting off the boat and experiencing it, and another Alice, slightly older, who's in jail, been condemned to die, and is recalling it. And there's actually one moment in the show where I managed to get them to sing together at the same time, which seemed appropriate for a ghostly opera.
Okay, so James, tell me a little bit about this music. I mean, it sounds, it's very lyric, and it sounds, just listening to it, like it feels good in the throat, but how would you describe the music itself?
I mean, I think you kind of hit it on the head. Every singer kind of gets nervous about getting a new score. You never know. You know, it could take years to get it down. And fortunately, Michael's stuff makes a lot of sense. It's beautiful. It does feel good. It's very singable. I've actually known Michael for about 5 years, and I'd never heard any of his music, I'm ashamed to say. So when I heard Alice for the first time, I was very impressed, and I'm very glad to be part of it.
Michael, let me bring this to you, and I, in interest of full disclosure, I'm biased on this issue. My grandfather's a composer and wrote nothing but melodies, and I liked
his music.
I wonder how you. I mean, you were highly educated. You went to a highfalutin Duke University, and I wonder how you feel about this attitude that still exists in classical music, that if it's not difficult and challenging, it's not intellectual music. Have you encountered that?
A lot. It's a horrible shame, and I guess the way I deal with it is that I would write for maybe highfalutin, difficult-sounding music if I thought that that was the particular audience I was writing for. But here in Savannah, the opera company, the Savannah Voice Festival, is very young. And the audience has a certain background in traditional opera. And then beyond that fairly new, young audience, there's an audience beyond that that may only have references to the music that they hear in church or the musical theater piece that they've gone to see at the community theater. So I feel like you have to write for the particular audience here. And so the piece was really designed to be accessible. And if somebody somewhere thinks I'm not writing sophisticated enough music, well, that's their problem and not mine.
Well, let's let the audience in on what it is we're talking about. Let's take a listen to some of the music. This is actually the chorus singing. It's on a trolley in present-day Savannah, where they're giving a tour, and it includes a Savannah native, Johnny Mercer, who wrote the lyrics to Moon River. Let's take a listen.
You'll hear Moon first.
Okay, so this is you with a sense of humor, and I bring this up because this is another way in which you're kind of breaking some of the traditions of opera here. Michael, how much do you let your own sense of humor come through in your writing something high art like opera?
Well, believe it or not, Celeste, I'm actually best known for comic opera, and so I like things that are funny. And this particular piece is a kind of Broadway piece that starts the opera, and then it goes into a more classical operatic style. So it's kind of like in La Traviata. You know that there's the Libiamo early on. It's a great piece that you want to sing along to. And I
most
think
people know them in Libiamo, Libiamo.
Yes, that's exactly yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Beautiful.
Keep going.
So there's a piece like that early on to get the audience comfortable that they can stay and enjoy the rest of it, and then it moves into a kind of operatic style after that.
Okay, well, James, let's actually take a listen to some of your singing in here. This is one of the most dramatic scenes in the opera, and your character, James Richard White, kills your master, William Wise. You're indentured servants, both you and Alice, and yep. He is actually insulting you while you and your lover, Alice Riley, are grooming him. He's disabled, so take a listen. Okay, so you strangle him.
And not particularly my singing, but something in there.
Right. I'm not talking about your tone. I'm talking about you actually strangling William Wise. And, you know, those kind of scenes can be really difficult for a singer because sometimes the tension in your body translates into tension in your voice. How do you overcome that?
Well, fortunately, Michael makes it so I don't have to sing while I'm killing him. I speak that line, and then after I kill him, I get two or three bars to catch my breath.
And I am talking to you.
and then I sing a few lines before Alice and I run away. And fortunately, I mean, that's a pretty big emotional climax. And then after that, I don't have to sing anymore. So he gave me the hard stuff at the end, and I can let it rip and take a break after that. But
it gives you that big high note, and then you can go backstage and kick back.
Yeah, and you know, it's fun to kill somebody on stage. I've never killed anyone. I've been killed on stage, but I haven't.
Wow,
killed
you've
anyone.
Never killed anybody in opera, because a lot of people die in opera. There's a lot
they
of
do.
Murder.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, you know, my voice type, I'm a more lyric baritone. I don't particularly do a lot of operas that are very intense like this. You
You'll
know,
grow up and kill a lot of people, Jim.
Exactly.
There are plenty of murderous baritones in opera, James.
Oh, of course.
Let's have to get you there. Let's take a little bit, another listen here, Michael. This is a lullaby, a lovely little lullaby that Alice actually sings to her baby. Here's a bit of that.
Sweet is thy baby smile. Angels are guardian and watch for thee.
And I may be reading a lot into it, but, you know, Alice, her execution was delayed when they found out that she was pregnant. And so I listen to that and I hear some of the chords and I think, wow, some of those, the discord in those chords must be this weird situation where she's had her baby in prison. That's the only thing keeping her alive. How do
you're absolutely right. That's, I mean, it's a sweet lullaby. It's an actual Irish lullaby, but it's dipped in this deep sorrow and foreboding about the fact that, now that I've had my baby, what's going to happen?
Yeah, she's going to die. That's what's going to happen. Yeah. Spoiler alert. So that's my my question for you is, how much foreshadowing do you put in terms of the fact that Alice Riley becomes a ghost? Do you deal with that musically?
Well, the ghost part of the ghost story is very deft. It is very fleeting, and as that should be, because when you're looking for a ghost, if the ghost is going to come up and shake your hand, that's not going to be very scary, is it? Well, I suppose it could be if it's a scary ghost. But the point is that it's handled very lightly, and I guess without giving it away, it's very much at the end of the opera, and it's kind of, I think Alice is kind of like the guilty conscience of Savannah or the colony, because you know here she is, the first woman hanged. I think she might have been the first person hanged at all, and she was at she, they probably shouldn't have done that, and so the fact that she's still haunting Wright Square, I think, is kind of a little bit of the guilty conscience of the culture.
That is composer Michael Ching and baritone James Wright. I spoke with them last year. The opera Alice Riley returns to the Savannah Voice Festival stage tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Westin Savannah Harbor Ballroom. Now let's add two more songs to our Essential Georgia playlist. We ask people to tell us what two songs best represent the Peach State. And the rules are really simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and the song can't be one of their own if they're a musician. And in the spirit of the Savannah Voice Festival, we decided to invite the event's founders, opera singers Cheryl Milnes and Maria Zuvis. They're married, and they're also working to build up Savannah's opera scene. And here are their picks for our Georgia playlist.
My name is Cheryl Milnes, an opera singer, retired now, sang all over the world, especially at the Metropolitan Opera, 32 years, more than 650 performances, which doesn't make me sweat now, but did then.
Moon River, wider than a mile.
Well, I guess the song that I would choose, because I don't know a ton of them, but obviously the biggest name is Johnny Mercer, and I suppose Moon River, because there is a Moon River here in the Savannah area. It's a great piece, and there's a couple of others Mercer songs, but that's perhaps the most famous.
Wherever you're going, I'm going your way.
How does that song go? You're not paying me to sing. So I don't do that anymore. Moon River. Actually, he didn't write the tune. He wrote the words. But the words are beautiful. And when you cross on one of the highways, you cross Moon River, it has special meaning. Music, you know, music appeals to the emotions of the human creature. And that's what music is about, emotion. And it touches me.
Waiting round the bend, my
huckleberry friend. Moon River and me.
Yeah, it was the main song in the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, and starring, among others, Audrey Hepburn. And, of course, who didn't love Audrey Hepburn? Actually, I met her at a couple of Metropolitan Opera affairs later in her life, but, you know, who didn't love Audrey Hepburn?
Moon River.
My name is Maria Zuvas, and I am a Greek-American soprano who now produces opera with the Cheryl Milnes Voice Programs.
Sue wants a barbecue, Sam wants to boil a ham, Grace votes for bouillabaisse stew.
Well, being part of Savannah, I would choose a Johnny Mercer song. I would choose In the Cool of the Evening.
We'll rent a tent or TV.
I love the part, when the party's getting the glow on and singing fills the air. I love that part. It's so much fun. You have to snap. You can't sing it without snapping.
When the party's getting the glow on, singing fills the air.
For us as opera people, it's a good thing to steer off the path of all that classical stuff and just have a good time. I think that Georgia is so diverse. There's so much going on in the state of Georgia in terms of music. It's not just about the region. It's about the people, and it's about their love of getting together and sharing music, because music is about coming together. So for me, Georgia is all kinds of music.
Savannah Voice Festival directors Cheryl Milnes and Maria Zuvas with their picks for our Georgia playlist. If you have a song or two that you want to nominate, you can always call us and sing a little. We welcome it. It's 404-500-9457. You can find all of our Georgia playlist picks at gpb.org. It's also on SoundCloud. That's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you, and I wonder if you have a ghost story. Do you have your own ghost story you can tell us? Have you seen something spooky or supernatural? Then we want to hear about it. You can tweet us. It's at OST Talk, or just post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.